Welcome to Speak Up, Speak Out, progressive voices from around the valley and around the nation, conversing about issues important to our community.
So the issue is that comparing our health system with those in healthcare system with those in other nations, we don't look so good, yet we spend half of the world's healthcare bill. But it's not healthcare that makes us healthy. That's the ultimate truth divulged by much research. And I say this as a medical doctor who's practiced for 35 years. During this period, working in the emergency department, I've treated heart attacks, motor vehicle crashes, shoulder dislocations, and stabbings. I could help many of these people. But when you add up all that medical care does, it still doesn't make that much of a difference. So the question we should be asking is, do we want health or health care? My answer is, I want both. But first, I want health, since that's what life is all about.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Speak Up, Speak Out. I'm Jenny Wolf. The voice you just heard was Dr. Stephen Bezruchka speaking in Bellingham last winter, challenging the tacit assumption that our success or failure to deliver health care to more people is what determines health outcomes. Dr. Bezruchka will be a featured speaker at the Human Rights Festival in Mount Vernon on Friday, March 26th at the Philip Tarrow Theater at Skagit Valley College. Dr. Bezruchka studies population health, an inquiry into what factors determine the health of various societies. Trained at Harvard, Stanford, and Johns Hopkins Universities, he has over 30 years' experience working as an emergency room physician. He currently teaches in the Department of Global Health at the University of Washington and helps run the Population Health Forum there. Dr. Bezruchka also has spent a good portion of his professional life in Nepal. I interviewed him last winter and replay portions of this interview today. His talk on March 26th is entitled, Health as a Human Right. Is Capitalism Killing Us? Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, I am delighted to welcome you to Speak Up, Speak Out.
Thank you very much, Jenny. I'm pleased to be here.
In the midst of the current political debate over reforming healthcare access, you prefer to talk about health. Why?
Well, what do we want? I would guess that most Americans would rather be healthy than be sick and have a lot of access to doctors and hospitals and medicines and surgeries and tests and scans and all that. Given the choice, what do you want? You want to be healthy or do you want to be sick and have all that stuff to try and make you better? So I put the choice that way. Ideally, we should have both because, you know, we will get sick. But it's not medical care that makes us healthy. That's the key thing that needs to be addressed. Medical care is something you do to treat illness. And by many measures, we have some of the best health care available in the world. In other words, people flock here from around the world to get treated. But the lack of health care is not what makes you sick.
So we're told that the U.S. trails other developed countries in many measures of health, such as life expectancy and infant mortality. And this is widely attributed, especially in the current debate going on about how we're going to reform healthcare access. This is widely attributed, at least in part, to high numbers of uninsured persons here. But you're saying that that's not the case, correct?
I'm saying that we don't do well. That is, when we look at measures of our health compared to other countries, there is absolutely no one out there that I know of that can make a statement that that our measures of our health, how well we are doing, compare highly with those of other countries. And for this, I like to use, you know, major sources of data. And so, for example, the day before yesterday, a report came out from our United States Department of Health and Human Services, Center for Disease Control, the National Center for Health Statistics. And the report looked at rankings of infant mortality, and it was titled Behind International Rankings of Infant Mortality, How the United States Compares with Europe. And it had a number of graphs there showing that compared to the European countries, and in that they included countries such as Slovakia and Poland and Hungary and the expanded Europe, were close to the bottom in infant mortality. What proportions of children born die in their first year of life? And so the headline on the first page of this 8-page report, lots of this material goes back 30, 40 years or a year ago, but and I'm always interested, is this stuff still current? And unfortunately, not only is it current, the the picture is not looking any brighter. So, you know, we rank down at the bottom there with Slovakia. In this report, they address, maybe it's because we have all these premature births. So they excluded births at less than 22 weeks of gestation. And we were fourth from the bottom. Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia were below us. Preterm births. Now that we have a lot of prematures as well, and that's above 22 weeks, but still below 40. And we're at the bottom there. By bottom, I mean worst. And they also looked at some countries define a live birth differently. In this country, if you have a birth and there's any signs of life whatsoever, that's called a live birth. Whereas in some countries, if it dies on the first day of life, it's called a stillborn. So they said even, you know, with those different definitions of a live birth, we still look absolutely wretched in this government, in this government-produced report. I mean, if our government is saying this, well, we can't always trust the government, but we wouldn't expect them to say this if it wasn't true. And furthermore, this got a quarter page in the New York Times yesterday. So that's saying something. You know, major newspapers are featuring this. I've been talking about this for 20 years or so, namely we're not doing so well. So why do we have such high infant mortality rates in this country? Well, the first thing we can say is it doesn't have anything to do with medical care. It's not like these newborns are lacking medical care, because the one place where nothing is spared is for a newborn to receive all the best high-tech care, whether anybody can pay or not. In other words, if you have insurance, they'll bill insurance. If you can pay, they'll pay, and if you can't pay, then the state pays. So at no level of newborn care do we spare anything to provide the best, and yet our outcomes are the worst. So by its very nature, in that particular case, not having access to health care doesn't exist, and we do the worst. Now, once you say we have 45 million, 50 million uninsured, and isn't that the reason? Unfortunately, the studies show that's not true. And again, I could get into the specific studies, but you know, the key thing to understand is that medical care is a very good thing for treating certain conditions for which medical care is effective. The lack of medical care is not the reason for getting sick. And besides being effective at treating conditions, medical care also doesn't work for a lot of things, and sometimes it can cause harm. And so if you add up what it can do well and what it doesn't do well and what it, and when it sometimes does harm, it turns out to be a wash. That is, there are no net benefits. That's what all the studies say.
So in your study of population health, what does the evidence find to be general determinants of the health of a society if it's not the presence or absence of availability to health care?
It turns out that the striking research over the last 30, 40 years has shown that it's the social and economic characteristics of a society, namely how the wealth of society, the resources of society are shared with its members, that create the conditions for good health. And, you know, I sort of say a society that people are cared for and shared with, if everybody has enough to eat and clean water or roof over their head if they need it, a society where that happens is going to be healthier than a society that makes people look out for their own welfare. That is, if we're all individuals and we're not in this boat together, then we tend to drown. And so, you know, people who don't have friends die younger. People who are sick and don't have friends have worse outcomes. When is that friendship, that caring and sharing, most important? Turns out to be most important in very early life. Research over the last decade or two has suggested that perhaps half of our health as adults is determined before we go to school. Half of our health as adults is determined between conception and age 3, 4, 5. At the University of Washington, we have a problem-based learning master's in public health program, and we're just completing the introductory block. Last year, my students came up with this phrase, early life lasts a lifetime. So in this, they were asked to research on their own where in the lifespan is so much of our health determined. And if you take smart people and give them all the library and resources and access to people to ask those questions of, uniformly they come up with the same answer: early life matters most. So what does that mean, early life matters most? Well, it's turning out that the time from conception to birth is critically important for development, how we end up as adults. If you think about it, we all began life as a fertilized egg. The ovum, the maternal component, your mother made when she was in your maternal grandmother's womb. So your maternal grandmother matters for your health. Then that fertilized egg divides 42 times, roughly, to produce a newborn. It then only divides about another 5 times to produce an adult. Now, when cells are dividing, all sorts of factors can impact them. Drugs can, smoking can, alcohol can, pollution can, and we are discovering stress can. And so stress turns out to be a major factor that wreaks havoc upon our system. What is the stress response for? You know, you turn it on for a few seconds to get out of the way of the oncoming car, and it saves your life. But if you turn it on all the time, worried about whether the check is in the mail, whether your significant other is going to beat you, whether the kid's going to come home with the truant officer, you know, putting some shackles on him. When we worry about all these things, it's not really a healthy situation. So societies that decrease stress in society or share the stress by providing, for example, a livable wage, by providing daycare, by providing maternity, paternity leave, by providing prenatal leave, all these things are the kinds of medicines, population medicines, that have a huge impact. And unfortunately, in our country, we don't have any prenatal paid leave policies, nor any maternity, paternity paid leave policies. Sure, you know, some companies are generous and they allow you to take some unpaid leave. Some of them will even give you a little bit of paid leave. But as a country as a whole, we don't have those. And that's where we need to make the first baby steps to trying to improve our health, to support early life.
When I heard you speak in Bellingham, you talked about the gap between the rich and the poor being an important determinant of the health of the society overall. And I presume this is what you're talking about with living with chronic stress.
Yes. So caring and sharing really is the key factor. Yeah, that's such a fuzzy concept, caring and sharing. So how are we going to measure that? Well, there's a variety of ways, and one that I think makes the most sense is, how do we decide to apportion what's ours, what belongs to Americans in this country? How do we decide to apportion that to people? Well, we never asked that question. You know, basically, you have to make your salary and accumulate wealth and pay for all the things that you need to survive. But that's not right. For example, you know, the soil, the ground, actually, most of it is public land, and that can be, and choices are made about what to do with that. The airwaves, that's public, that's ours. Choices are made about what to do with that. When people make money or they invest, is some of that, do the society pay for the ability to make those investments? Yes, of course it does. When people pump oil out of the ground, that's our oil. So societies have resources, and decisions are made about how to share those resources. And in this country, we decide to give most of it to the rich. And I say we because we, the people, ultimately have all the power in this country. And the example of the bailouts over the last years is really highlights how the bankers and the big businesses panicked and got their bailouts, and I think most of us are still waiting for ours. So, you know, roughly many trillions of dollars have gone out of the public purse, our resources, to the rich. And we have seen this really rebuild the wealth share of, say, the richest 1%. Back in the 1920s, the richest 1% in this country had close to half of all the wealth. Through a variety of processes, political processes that came as a result of public agitation in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, by the 1975, the wealth of the richest 1% had shrunk to less than a quarter, about 23% in 1975. Well, now it's back to half. How did the rich get their wealth? So in 1975, you know, it was the wealth share was much more equitable. It wasn't the rich having half of it, the richest 1%. Now it's back to that. So the rest of us have been relatively impoverished. And I say relatively because, you know, even relatively poor people in this country, people down on their luck, you know, they have a cell phone, they have a microwave, they have all sorts of gadgets that even Dick Tracy couldn't have imagined. So it's not whether you have the stuff that makes you feel poor. It's recognizing how much less you have than others. And how do we demonstrate how much we have? Well, we do it all the time. You know, the cars we drive, the homes we live in, the designer labels we strut around in, the way we treat other people. Societies with a smaller gap between the rich and the poor, with more income equality, have more trust, more caring and sharing relationships, and by and large, almost any health indicator is going to be better in a society with a smaller gap between the rich and the poor.
You are listening to Speak Up, Speak Out. I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Bisruchka, medical doctor and professor at the University of Washington, about why the U.S. is so unhealthy in spite of spending so much money on health care. Dr. Bisruchka will be speaking at the Skagit Valley College in the Philip Terrell Theater as part of the Human Rights Festival on Friday, March 26th at 7 p.m. Dr. Bisruchka, you just sort of chronicled briefly the history of wealth distribution in this country and how we got to where we are today, even though time constraints don't allow a lot of detail. Can you talk a little bit about our current recession, how it happened, and how it fits into all of this?
Well, it's interesting. I was just reading one of my problem-based learning student postings on just this topic before you called, and you know, I have my own ideas, and either this person read my mind or she thinks more or less the same way that I do. Basically, worker wages adjusted for inflation have been flat since the early 1970s. That is, for some reason, we stopped paying people more money as they produced more. Starting back in the early 1800s, worker wages per unit production rose constantly. It was almost a law of economics that you worked harder and produced more and you got paid more. But that got unraveled in the 1970s when productivity went up, namely our economy was growing and producing more, but worker wages were stagnant. So what happened was, you know, people wanted to still buy more, you know, live the American dream and have the two-garage car. So what they did was put more family members to work. So if you take, for example, a two-child, two-parent, median income family in 1970 and compare with one person staying at home and the other person working, and compare that with a two-parent, two-child, 2000 median family, median means middle, with both parents working, it turns out that they have less disposable income, the 2000 family with both parents working, than the 1970 family. In other words, after you paid for all the necessities, food, housing, health care, educational expenses, you had more money to play with back in 1970 with one person working than you did in 2000. So one of the things we did when we weren't being paid more was we put the other half out there to work. So women entered the workforce. Children entered the workforce. I mean, more and more kids, you know, hold jobs now to pay for their own expenses. Then we started borrowing on home equity. As housing prices rose, you know, people could get mortgages against the increase in value of their homes. And that might make sense if you wanted to fix up your home, but more likely you were to spend it for vacation. So people spent it on consumer goods. And it didn't matter because next year your house price would go up and you would refinance. Well, that worked pretty well for a long time, and the banking system really sucked us in. I mean, they made a lot of ninja loans. No income, no job, no assets. You qualify for a loan. At some point, people also started paying with plastic and borrowing against plastic. And I see this among my students. They have huge debts as they struggle to pay for educational expenses and living expenses, and they shuffle them among the 0% interest for a certain period of time credit card offers they always get. So, you know, they'd get the 0% interest credit card, they'd throw a whole bunch of their loans onto that, and then when that was going to turn over and start charging interest, another card would come along, they'd throw their debt into that. I mean, it's really fascinating to talk to the students and how they were doing this, but they had no other choice because their parents weren't making enough money, and educational expenses were rising far higher than inflation. Well, what happened was, about 2002, a very astute economist, Dean Baker, he wrote a paper in August 2002 saying, suddenly housing prices have risen higher than equivalized rents. And he said, this can't go on. There's going to be a bubble. It's going to burst. Well, I downloaded that report. I have it on my computer, but nobody paid any attention to it. I mean, Alan Greenspan was preaching irrational exuberance. This is just wonderful. You know, the chairman of the Fed. And everybody was in this frenzy, just feeding at the trough. But then suddenly housing prices stopped increasing, and suddenly there was panic. And there's a rule in any sort of unstable situation, the rule is don't panic. But there's another rule, too. In any kind of unstable situation, panic first. So who panicked first? Well, the banksters. They got their trillions. I mean, you know, it was amazing how in a little over a couple of weeks, we gave the first trillion to the banksters through Paulson. When the Senate and the House voted on a bill to give him basically carte blanche to take our trillions and give it to the bankers because they were too big to fail. Well, that set off this frenzy of bailouts. And it set the economy in a tailspin, and it had repercussions all around the world. That's the amazing thing, that it was our housing bubble that burst, and it just rippled all around the world. It just sort of shows how interconnected we all are. And so the solutions to all of this has got to come by a kind of international cooperation we have never, ever engaged in before. But that's sort of the situation. So that's the crisis. Now, turns out, during crises or recessions, health seems to improve more. Like, there's a background situation. That is, the last century, health has been improving pretty well all of the last century in rich countries and around the time of independence in poor ones. But during recessions, health improves faster than during economic booms. Those are the research findings that were actually unearthed back in the late 1800s, published in the 1920s. Everybody said, oh, this is nonsense. How could things get better when things get worse? And then they were revisited in the 1970s. Same thing was true. Finally revisited again starting in 2000. And there's now a rich, robust literature on just that idea. So why would health, mortality, fall more during recessions than during booms? Well, it has to do with people working two or three jobs and all the stress of all the loans and the hectic lives. You know, right now, our deaths from motor vehicle crashes for 2009 up to September per mile traveled are the lowest they've been since 1961. And that's because people are driving less and there's less road rage out there. And that's just one example. We haven't got data yet analyzed for this current recession, but heart attack deaths go down. Alcoholism deaths go down. The only thing that goes up is suicides. Suicides tend to go up during recessions. So there are, you know, people are hurt by recessions, and I'm not saying that this is a gravy train, but I am saying that what happens is people pull together. They care and share more with one another during tough times than during booms. You know, the phrase, brother, can you spare a dime? That was a phrase from the Great Recession. And people did spare dimes. And we have now studies on the Great Recession showing that health actually improved pretty remarkably. Very counterintuitive. And yes, always poorer people will have poorer health, and poorer people will be hurt more in recessions than or depressions than richer people. But the health disparity gap, I would venture to say, narrows.
It sounds to me like you're advocating some kind of income redistribution in this country.
I'm advocating that we put as a goal to become one of the healthiest countries in the world and do whatever it takes to do that. You know, countries have goals. We had a goal in the 1960s of landing a human on the moon, and we measured progress towards that goal, and we were successful. We have a goal right now, and that is to make the rich ever richer, and we're very successful in that. We need a new goal. I suggest it's that we not die so young.
Before you leave us, is there any way where you would refer people interested in learning more, a website?
Well, we have our Population Health Forum at the University of Washington that tries to make these ideas better known. The easiest way to get that is search for Health Olympics. you know, health should be an Olympic event, and it's the first thing that pops up.
Google Health Olympics, I think, does it. You have been listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, emergency room physician, professor of population health studies at the University of Washington, discussing the social and economic roots of our poor health outcomes in this country. I want to play another excerpt from Dr. Bezruchka's Bellingham Address about how our failure to prioritize early childhood concerns impacts learning and school performance as well as health.
Societies that are more equal have many more good things going for them. For example, they live longer lives, they have fewer teen births, fewer youth homicides, and they have better educational outcomes in schools. Let's look at how well our schools are doing as in educating American children. Last week, a report came out showing that our national progress on the No Child Left Behind goals for mathematics prowess has plateaued. We're already far behind the other rich nations in our mathematics and science abilities and no longer making progress. The key point is that other nations are able to get their students to way outperform our children on standardized tests. One reason that we import educated people from other countries to do the technical work in the computer industry, for example, results from our having not enough smart people to do the work. Our schools just don't produce the talented software engineers and designers. The key concept that's not addressed in the United States of America is that studies show that our cognitive ability as young people is not up to the challenge of learning more and more. It used to be, but something has transpired to make us less capable of learning. Now, there's a variety of perspectives on this. I believe that this is because we've compromised early life, so our children are less capable of learning. Again, I'm speaking of averages, and there are always exceptions. More of us are now set up to fail and blame ourselves for not making it. The point I'm trying to make is that we're producing children in our country whose potential is not what it used to be. And that's the result of various social and political choices we've made. Studies show that if a child grows up in poverty, especially poverty in the first year of life, it is like being exposed to a toxin that irreversibly binds to the brain, in which there's no antidote you can administer later in life to rid the child of the scourge. Early life lasts a lifetime.
Dr. Stephen Bezruchka will be speaking at the Human Rights Festival on Friday, March 26th. That presentation will start at 7 p.m. and is at the Philip Tarot Theater on the campus of Skagit Valley College. The evening will consist of about an hour-long presentation entitled, Health as a Human Right, Is Capitalism Killing Us? It will be followed by a question and answer session. Please join us Friday, March 26th at 7 p.m. And don't miss the Human Rights Festival's event this week, Friday, March 19th, for the film Rethink Afghanistan and a short documentary entitled Unarmed Civilian Peacekeeping, Building a Nonviolent Peace Force. A discussion follows the films. This event is Friday, March 19th, from 7 to 9 p.m. And that's it for Speak Up, Speak Out tonight. Have a nice week. Join us each week for Speak Up, Speak Out. Archives are at speakupspeakoutradio.org. Theme music courtesy of Kurt Crandall. Until next time, seek peace, work for justice, celebrate diversity, and support your neighbors.
This program was produced in the studios of KSVR-FM by the Speak Up, Speak Out Collective. Distribution was made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.